Greetings, urban farmers, gardeners, and healthy food visionaries. Farmer Greg here, and welcome to the 816th episode of the Urban Farm Podcast, where every day we work together to educate and inspire you to become part of your food revolution. Today in our podcast, we have someone who is offering an alternative to farmers markets. We're talking with Aaron Zaretsky about creating public markets. Aaron spent 15 years as a director at Seattle's Pike Place Public Market, the nation's most successful public market with 15 million annual customer visits. The market's redevelopment is credited with transforming downtown Seattle from the nation's original skid row with countless derelict buildings into the nation's healthiest and most prosperous downtown. Pike Place is also the number one tourist attraction in the surrounding six-state region. For 41 years through his company, Public Market Development, Aaron has helped to analyze, plan, redevelop, develop, and manage over 50 public markets across the country and internationally. Welcome to the show today, Aaron. Are you ready to rock?
You bet.
Awesome. So I shared a bit about you. Can you fill in the blanks for us and share more about the path you took to get where you're at today?
I was one of those kids who, after college, flew Icelandic Airlines for $115 to Europe and bought a VW bus for $50 and spent over a year visiting pretty much every country in Eastern Europe, Western Europe, Africa. And when you're young and interested in politics and interested in food and people and culture, what I found myself doing was traveling from public market to public market in literally hundreds of cities across Europe and North Africa. And I just fell in love with the concept and felt like it was an incredible venue for bringing together communities, creating a common ground in cities where different kinds of people rub shoulders. And that's where it all began.
Wow. So for those people that don't know what a public market is, could you share what they might be or what they look like?
Yeah, it's a complicated question because people have different ideas of it. It's really, public markets have been around since people started gathering in cities about 6,000 years ago. It was the place where producers would bring their food and their wares and where consumers would come to buy. If you look at the earliest digs in the Mesopotamian Valley, the heart of the community at that time, 6,000 years ago, was the marketplace. I've done over 50 public markets, almost all of them include a farmer's market. So it's not instead of a farmer's market, it's in addition to a farmer's market. What characterizes a public market as opposed to a farmer's market is that it's indoor, it's year-round, it's permanent businesses, it's not itinerant, it's 6 or 7 days a week, and it's a way for people to come together to not only sell their wares, but to be able to earn a living and put their kids through college. Mm-hmm. A lot of public market vendors are immigrants. There's a strong emphasis on creating an environment that welcomes different kinds of people, low-income, middle-income, and upper-income people. They're very diverse, and probably one of the main characteristics is that they create a common ground that brings different kinds of people together who don't ordinarily rub shoulders in a safe and exciting and fun environment. Probably one of the most salient stories I can tell you in terms of what makes them work is when I was a director at Pike Place, we did a survey. We asked two questions at the local mall and of public market customers. We asked, why'd you come today and how much did you spend? And at the mall, 94% basically said, I came to shop. I needed a vacuum cleaner bag, and this was the place to get it. At the public market, only 24% of the respondents came to shop. They came because it was exciting, it was fun, it was colorful. They wanted to teach their kids that meat didn't grow in styrofoam containers, that it grow in paper bags, and that they wanted to have their children understand where food comes from and what's important about the creation of the food that we eat. So they didn't come to shop, but then when we looked at the how much people spent, they actually spent twice as much money at the public market than they did at the mall, even though they didn't, quote, come to shop, close quotes. That's the secret to creating successful public market, is it's the experience. It's not the typical merchandising, the kind of slick sales that characterize most of American retail.
Wow. So I had an experience with a public market back in 2014. I visited Zagreb, Croatia. I was there on a university project for Arizona State University that I worked with back then and was blown away. This public market was indoor and outdoor, and there must have been 200 vendors, and it was 7 days a week, and it was like this small festival. It was fun to go to. And so you've been to Zagreb, you've seen this?
I have. I did a project for a Middle Eastern country creating a public market. I've worked in about 10 different countries in addition to the 50 cities that I've worked in the US. And they paid me to go to about 20 different cities, mostly in Europe, and document their public markets. And it was just an incredible experience. I mean, public markets throughout the world, and we're talking not just in the US, but in Europe, in Asia, in Africa, in Australia, they're the heart and soul of the community. They're the community pulse tick, and you can, it's the place that people go to get a sense of what's really unique and special about the community. If I'm a developer and I want to develop a supermarket, I'm going to take the plans off the shelf. And one supermarket is pretty much like another supermarket. You walk in the door, the produce is on the right, the dairy is in the back, the meat, and there's a formula for what makes a successful supermarket. Markets are unique. They're very finely tuned to the communities that they inhabit. They reflect the culture and the needs of that community, and they are absolutely embody the uniqueness and the culture of the communities that they inhabit.
So let's visit Pike's Place in our mind. Can you walk us in and give us a visual picture of what we would be seeing and how many vendors there might be and what kind of vendors?
Yeah, and again, part of what I do is I help communities determine what kind of tenant mix would be successful. But you absolutely, one of the things that characterizes public markets is that people will drive by two or three supermarkets to shop for fresh food at quote unquote their public market because it's fun and it's exciting. They're going to meet their friends, they're going to see things that they wouldn't find in a typical supermarket. It's experiential. Pike Place Market has about 450 separate vendors, including over 100 farmers. I believe it's about 500,000 square feet. They just nearly doubled in size. They did a huge expansion, and they get over 15 million visitors a year.
That's amazing.
One of the things that's important about public markets is that they help to create a sense of community. So when I started at Pike Place Market, downtown Seattle was the heart of what was called Skid Road. And the reason it was called Skid Road was that the guy named Henry Esler had a lumber mill at the top of the hill overlooking downtown and would mill lumber and then run it down the hill to the harbor on skids that were covered with oxen grease. And that lumber would then go by ship to San Francisco and LA and Portland to build those cities. And downtown at that time was really characterized by flop houses and boarded up retail and boarding houses. It was not when all of the things that Skid Road has come to connote, but the original Skid Road was downtown Seattle. And when I started working there, it was still very much the place where elderly people lived, where low-income people lived, had a population of about 8,000. We started the vision at Pike Place was to create a healthy downtown, but not just by gentrifying and getting rid of the traditional population. What we wanted to do was stabilize that population. So we created a community health clinic. We created a senior center. We created
Wow.
a food bank. We created a child care center. We created a house for frail elderly where frail elderly people could live. We created a house for runaway kids. And we took as one of our founding principles that there would be at least as many affordable low-income housing units after the renovation of Pike Place as before. And the population of downtown Seattle went from 8,000 to over 100,000. And I'm proud to say that the number of affordable housing units is far more now than there were then. But it's also a place where, when I left in 91 as a director, there were housing units overlooking the market that were 2,200 square feet that were selling for $5 million. It's some of the most expensive housing literally in the world on a per square foot basis. It's clearly a place for upper income people. There's a lot of middle income people, and it's still a home to a significant population of lower income people. But
Wow.
that commitment to a mixed income community looking more beyond the tomatoes and zucchinis that make up the market is very much a part of the vision of public markets, at least as I see it.
Wow. And who did you work with in order to recreate Pike's Place?
Oh, we raised $70 million in funding. It was a whole laundry list of federal, state, local, private grant funds. We worked with, there were countless community meetings. There were countless interactions. We were in the paper all the time. There were lots of vehicles. And this was all pre-computers, so we weren't on, but we did everything we could to assure that it was a place that really reflected the community's needs and its culture.
And so back to my question, though, is it was that kind of facilitated by the city government?
No, it was not. It's actually an interesting history. In America, if you go to the Library of Congress and go to virtually any city in the country and go to their photographic archives, go to any city in the country and type in public market, you'll see that the heart of that city was the public market. We're talking literally hundreds, if not thousands, of public markets. And it's obviously not the case today. When we were working on Pike Place, there were just a handful of public markets that hadn't been urban renewalized out of existence. And in 1971, the city of Seattle, Mayor Ullman, was able to get a $30 million grant from HUD to tear down Pike Place Market. And the vision was to tear it down, build office towers and condos and a new parking garage. And on the 13th floor of the new parking garage was going to be the new saved public market. And that was the plan.
Wow.
A guy named Victor Steinbrück, who is an incredible architect. He was the architect who designed the Space Needle, thought that wasn't such a good idea. And he started a group called Friends of the Market. And Seattle has a citizens' initiative process where you can actually create a law if you get enough signatures on a petition. And he started a petition that rather than enacting this plan, that the money be used to rehab the market and preserve it. And the city of Seattle spent about $250,000 in fighting the initiative. This was communist propaganda and would never work. And when the votes were counted, about 80% of the population voted in favor of the initiative to save the market. The
Wow.
mayor got on television the next morning and said, "This is great. We've been for this all along." And took total credit for it, which was just fine. And he created a public development authority, in essence, a nonprofit, to manage the redevelopment. And I was one of the directors of that redevelopment authority. So it was similar to an airport authority.
Yeah. So that was in 1971. Did the redevelopment in earnest start in 1991?
No, the redevelopment started. I came on board in 77. The redevelopment had already begun, and was the major part of the redevelopment happened in the late 70s and early 80s. We spent about $65, $70 million on the redevelopment. And then recently, about 3 years ago, it virtually doubled in size with additional funding.
Wow. And that's just right along the, if I'm remembering correctly, it's just right along the water's edge, isn't it? Isn't it?
It's overlooking the water's edge. It's a couple, three blocks back from the water, but it definitely has a view of the water. Again, there downtown Seattle is a hillside that terraces up.
Wow. How does that make you feel to have seen the progress and the success of that market? Because it's probably one of the most successful, it is the most successful market in the country.
Yeah, it is absolutely the most successful market in the country. Because of the success of Pike Place Market, there's been about 350 new public markets that have been created in the US and in Canada. I should say that Canada has some of the best public markets anywhere, just incredible. In fact, this is heresy for a previous director at Pike Place, but my favorite market in North America is the Granville Island in Vancouver.
Oh, wow.
Incredible market and create incredible. Part of what makes markets successful is not just what happens inside the building, but what happens in the surrounding area and the environment. And the public amenities, the art, the compatible uses are critical to the success of what happens inside the market. Again, it's not just about selling tomatoes and cheese. There's been several new tendencies in the development of public markets, which have, at least in my mind, not been very successful. With the incredible success of public markets, private developers came in and said, "Well, I can do that. We don't need government money or out private money to do this." And this probably started with a guy named Jim Rouse, and he developed the concept of quote unquote festival markets. And let's put in these high-end uses and Crabtree and Evelyn and Banana Republic and Victoria's Secrets and Gucci shoes and,
Sounds like a mall to me.
yeah, it's the high-end mall, but in their mind, what characterized it was there were festivals, there were events, there were amenities, there were balloons and banners, and trying to create a non-mall-like environment. And there's a magazine that chronicles urban development that had an article called "After the Festival is Over," and it basically chronicled the bankruptcy of about 25 different festival markets.
Oh, wow.
Rouse was tremendously successful at getting cities to commit many millions of dollars to create these entities, and virtually every one of them has failed. and were characterized. And the reason that they failed was that most people can't afford what was being sold in these markets. The idea any healthy public market is going to have goods that appeal to lower income, middle income, and upper income people. But to have a homogenous upscale market is not a path to success. In fact, one good example of this is a private developer. The main arcade at Pike Place, if you've been there, is always a chock-a-block full of customers. You're literally shoulder to shoulder with other customers. And a private developer, Harbor Development Company, built something called the South Arcade that connected with the main arcade, thinking we've got these millions of people, we can live off of that success. And it's just really telling because you go through the main arcade and it's still as crowded as ever. And then you go to the South Arcade, which is directly connected, and there's no sign that says you're now entering a private developer. But as soon as you go into the South Arcade, which is all upscale, all much more expensive goods, there's no customers. It's empty.
Interesting.
Yeah. And there's some wonderful public markets. For example, the Ferry Terminal Market in San Francisco is really beautiful architecturally. It is totally focused on fresh food, but it's all, I mean, if you want to buy a pound of cheese for $90 a pound,
No.
place to get it.
Yeah.
But despite the fact that it is diverse and has the kind of the full array of fresh foods, it really is not very popular and not very successful. Another trend in public markets is these so-called food halls, or again, privately developed markets that just are restaurants and
Like a food court.
yeah, exactly. And they too were nowhere near as successful as public markets. People eat. People spend more money on fresh food and eating at home than they do in restaurants. And that's increasing, not decreasing. It's absolutely important for public markets to include some stalls that sell food, perhaps some restaurants, perhaps a brew pub, wood-fired pizza. But the core of the public market needs to be the full array of fresh food. And when I say fresh food, I'm not just talking farm produce. I'm talking deli, I'm talking meat, fish, cheeses, everything that you would find in a traditional supermarket.
Yeah. It sounds to me like one of the big success factors for a public market is local.
Yeah, it's local and it absolutely has to reflect local goods, but it's not, and there are differences among people who are experts in public markets about this. But for example, the Boston public market limits itself to only local. You cannot be a vendor there unless you're selling local products. What that's meant is that, first of all, a lot of what people want to eat is not available. You can't buy bananas all year, or you can only buy tomatoes seasonally in Boston. But it's also much pricier. It's much more expensive. It doesn't have that kind of diversity of price points that make public markets successful. So while local is important, it needs to be part of a broader mix. I'm not a believer in limiting to only local. All things being equal, I would absolutely choose a local vendor over a non-local vendor. But the key, you would ask what determines a public market. The key is really that there's no chain stores, there's no franchises, it's owner operators. It's people who are there every day who have a stake in it. I remember there was a guy named Zev Siegel who came to us at Pike Place Market, and he had bought a coffee roaster and had it in his garage and was giving it away to his friends. And everybody said, "This is really fabulous coffee. You need to open up a little coffee shop." This is in the first half of the 70s.
Wow.
He came to us and said, "You want to rent space for a coffee shop?" And we said, "Bring some in, let's taste it and see how it goes." And he brought it in, and by God, it was really great coffee. And so we rented him a space, and he and his wife are rolled up their sleeves and are out there building out their space. And we're there on a Sunday, and they're putting up their sign, and I'm scratching my head thinking, who the hell, what a weird name for a coffee shop. Starbucks coffee?
Oh, wow.
Even though you are not allowed to rent to franchises, you can certainly franchise out from a public market. And there are a lot of Starbucks being the most famous, but Lata, Chuck E. Cherry's, the largest distributor of organic foods, literally in the country, Cascadian Foods, started as a small farm on Vashon Island, bringing in berry products and so forth.
Wow.
So, the place where businesses really can grow and be successful. And part of the function is to provide the technical support and the educational support to allow that to happen.
So it sounds like that's really one of the key factors is that you create a market and you build it around people that live in the area, their businesses that,
Oh,
yeah.
absolutely. Absolutely. 100% of the vendors are local, but the products that they're selling may or may not be local.
So you've been in this business most of your lifetime, and was there a moment that you stood back and saw something that happened or something that you created and said to yourself, "Oh my God, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing"?
I think Pike Place Market was that moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the creation of the community support network of the food senior center and medical clinic and so forth, all of which, by the way, are still operating, we were able to interact with and meet some incredible people. People may have learned about the Everett Massacre and the IW, the Industrial Workers of the World. And those people lived in downtown Seattle and were still alive at that time. And it was just incredible. My background before I got involved in the public markets is I'd been real active in the civil rights movement. And that was important to me
Yeah.
from the start. And I think helping to recreate Pike Place Market as a broadly beneficial, representative place that really appealed to the entire community and not just a particular cross section of the community was what was special to me. And
Yeah.
I've worked on a lot of other public markets that I feel very proud of. Findlay Market, for example, in Cincinnati. I did a master plan. It's one of those communities that had been entirely Polish and German, and with changing demographics in the cities, that population moved out. It was entirely African American. But when I was hired at Findlay Market, there were six vendors left, and they were all selling German products. Of the six vendors, I think four of them were selling different kinds of wursts and sausages. And once a year during key German holidays, everybody would come in from the suburbs to shop at Findlay Market, but other than that, it was totally a failure. And all the houses around were boarded up, and it was a classic slum. We did the master plan, and the city looked at it and said, "Oh no, we're not going to do this." And then, about a year later, the largest race riot or insurrection, as whichever way you would call it, happened in American history in the neighborhood over the Rhine around Findlay Market, and the city dusted off the master plan and basically implemented it. Today, there's over 200 vendors and farmers, all of the board, it's some of the most sought after housing in all of Cincinnati. The neighborhood, the over the Rhine neighborhood, is really one of the most successful mixed income, mixed race, mixed cultural communities anywhere in the country. It's not unusual to walk down the street and there's the place selling fried chicken wings, and next door is the five-star Michelin restaurant. In the market, significant number of the employees and business owners are African American or from the community. And you have, here's the place selling chitlins and hog jowls, and next to it is the place selling wheatgrass and smoothies. So it's that kind of classic mix of different uses, the different elements. And it works. It's full, it's very successful. It's full of customers, and that's a very important place.
Wow. Wow. It sounds like you've had an exciting life around building markets.
Yeah.
Tell me about your company and how you work with people.
Well, people find me mostly by word of mouth. I do have a website, publicmarketdevelopment.com, that has lots of information about what makes public markets successful, what defines them, where to find funding for them, how to develop them. It also has probably about, oh, 40 or 50 slideshows from around the world of different public markets and a little bit of a narration in terms of what makes them successful. But again, one of my most favorite markets in the world is in the highlands in Guatemala, in Chichicastenango, where this town of about 50 people, once a week, the indigenous people walk for days with their goods. And suddenly there's 30,000 customers and vendors, and it is the most colorful. It is absolutely extraordinary. And go to www.publicmarketdevelopment.com and go to the slideshow on Chichicastenango. You will be blown away at what it's like. But it's a totally indigenous market that is extraordinary. Right now, I'm in the process of writing a book. I've recently returned from, in this past year, I've visited about six or seven countries and looking at different public markets. But literally a few weeks ago, I just got back from Greenland and northern Norway. And in Greenland, the government not only supports public markets, but they also support craft markets. So it's Greenland is 95% indigenous, and it's the Inuit community, and the government provides tools and a housing for craftspeople. You can go in, and there's 40 different craftspeople making the most extraordinary carvings and prints and
Wow.
different art objects. It's a tool that takes different forms around the world, but is really very exciting and very unique and absolutely almost the opposite of malls. Part of the reason that more than 50% of the malls in this country have died is because they're boring.
Right?
You can get what you need online now, and there's nothing exciting, there's nothing interesting in most malls, unless, of course, you're a teenager looking to meet your colleagues. So malls have gone down by over 50% over the last decade when public markets have really exploded in cities across the country. One of the things about public markets is that they're not, they basically break even. They're not huge cash cows, but what they do is they create incredible tax dollar value and development value for the communities that surround them. There's a reason that people are spending $5 million for a small condominium next to Pike Place Market. And some developers have figured that out and are really working with a small handful of pretty progressive developers in different cities who are using public markets as a way to bring people to their development and to increase the value of their property. And it's important in doing that, but it's not exclusionary, that it's not a vehicle for gentrification, that it's a vehicle for creating a mixed income, mixed race community.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for all the work you've been doing. That's amazing. I'm getting excited just chatting with you.
Now it's fun.
So I'm going to shift on you, and I'd like for you to talk about a time you failed, how you overcame that failure, and what you might have learned from it.
Probably my worst, the only market that I've been involved with that in my mind was a total failure and is a total failure was in my hometown. I live outside of Asheville, North Carolina. There was a building there that was developed as a public market, and it was taken over by the federal government as part of the World War II effort and turned into the National Climatic Data Center. It's called the Grove Arcade. Absolutely gorgeous architecture. And when I moved to Asheville, it was about to be torn down. And I started a nonprofit called the Grove Arcade Public Market Foundation. We raised about $13 million to renovate the market and turn it into renovate the building and the public market. We needed a partner. The building was four stories. The Asheville didn't have the kind of market that could have used the entire building. And we partnered with the local utility company, thinking that they would be responsive to the local community and so forth for the development of the upper floors. They decided that a public market was not what they wanted, that what they wanted was a tourist attraction. They wanted the kind of upscale chain stores and franchises. They weren't at all interested in the vision of a public market. And there was a huge fight, and I failed and I lost. And it's now an upscale mall that is not especially successful. I feel very proud of having preserved the building, which would have been torn down, but
Yes.
the use is not at all what was envisioned. And it was really at that point, I had done some consulting beforehand, but it was really at that point that I decided that this idea was worth taking to the rest of the country and to the rest of the world, and formed public market development. And since then, I've worked on over 50 public markets throughout the world.
Nice. And the Grove Arcade is a stunning building. I can't imagine that they were wanting to tear it down.
Oh, yeah. Most of the public markets that were torn down during the, I call it urban removal, it was the temple in the city. It was like the best architecture in the city, all over the world, because people loved it. It was where people came together and people cared about it. And that's starting to come back.
And what do you consider your biggest success?
My children. I think Pike Place Market and the work I've done with public market development and helping communities all over the country create successful environments that really have had a huge impact on their neighborhoods, on their downtowns, have helped cities by generating enormous increased tax value in terms of real estate taxes, have helped a lot of vendors who would otherwise not be able to make a living. One of the things that that I've been conscious of in this era, when there's a huge amount of negative publicity about immigrants, many public markets have owners who are immigrants, and those are the people who show up at 5 o'clock in the morning to set up, and they're still working at midnight. And not only the owners, but their families and their kids, and they're incredibly invested in the success of the market. And that elbow grease helps to create successful businesses. And I feel very proud being able to be a part of that success.
Wow, awesome. And what drives you? What's your big why?
I think the same thing that drove me when I was a high school kid working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the civil rights movement, a sense of equity, a sense of fairness, that people deserve to be treated fairly, that people deserve to lead a decent life, and that we want to create a society that is not based on the dog eat dog mentality, but is based on a sense of equity and is based on a sense of community and fairness.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you for that. That's epic. If you could recommend one book for our listeners, what would it be and why?
There really are no good books about public markets. About, oh, I don't know, 25 years ago, I was a co-author of a book on public markets, which I'm not particularly proud of. I am actually right now in the process of writing a book that won't be out for a couple of years that really addresses the whole importance of marketplaces to a new vision for what a marketplace can be. But I've got lots of books that I can recommend that I love, but they're not really about public markets.
Got it. You got a favorite one that's not about markets?
Oh, my Bible since I was a teenager was The Prophet by Kahil Gibran.
There you go. Awesome. And what final piece of advice you have for our listeners?
I think that if you are a customer, find out if your community has a public market and go visit it. If you are a developer, there's probably no more successful development that you can create in terms of adding value to your property and to your neighborhood than developing a public market. I think the larger point that I would make is that we live in a country that there's an enormous amount of division. And if you know what the Gini index is, it's a measure of rich versus poor, you know, what that distance is. And that has grown by leaps and bounds over the last decades. And I think that's not a good thing. I think when I was in Greenland, which is was an incredible experience because in Greenland, there's a tradition where if you're going into a small community, you'll be invited into someone's home and they'll serve cake and coffee and you'll be a vehicle for being able to ask questions and for them to ask questions of you as an outsider for the local indigenous people. And the home that I visited was this family. The guy had just come back from hunting and killing 13 caribou, and he had butchered them and distributed the meat to everybody in the community. And in America, somebody like that would be all puffed up and look at me, look what I did. And it was just normal. It was just people who had the skill and the ability were just expected to do that. He was incredibly soft-spoken and almost meek. What he was really proud of was that his dog team had won the race in the local town about 15 years ago, and he took out the trophy that he had won. That's what was important to him.
Nice.
It was shocking to be in a community where there really was no poverty, there was no extreme wealth. Everybody had a boat. Nobody had a yacht. Nobody had a rowboat. You go to the graveyards and the graves are the same height. And I'm not saying that's my vision for the US, but it was extraordinary that places like that exist. And I think that the poor people in this country deserve much more of a leg up. And I think that the extremely wealthy people in this country can do well by sharing a little more.
Yeah, amen to that. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today, Aaron.
It was a pleasure. Visit publicmarketdevelopment.com if you're interested. My contact information is there if you're interested in learning more about it. And I enjoyed it. Good luck.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you. Thank you. You can also find show notes from today's podcast at urbanfarm.org/public-market-development.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Urban Farm Podcast. Remember to listen for tips, advice, and resources to help you on your journey with urban farming. You can find us on the web at urbanfarm.org or send us an email to podcast@urbanfarm.org. In the words of Vincent Van Gogh, great things are done by a series of small things brought together. Be encouraged that with each lesson learned and skill developed, you are one step closer in the direction of your dreams.